Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yes, we probably should have seen it coming. I mean, who spends $275 million to build a ski slope in the desert? What we have in Dubai isn't quite a financial meltdown, but it is close enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the last day of November 2009. Good to have you with us. Las Vegas, Nevada, and the global financial crisis aren't often mentioned in the same sentence, but with the opening in Vegas this week of a brand new $8.5 billion development owned in part by a company from Dubai, the stars do seem to have aligned. The Vegas City Center development is still scheduled to open as planned tomorrow, even though Dubai World announced a freeze in its debt repayments last Wednesday. For that company's investors, it is still very much a roll of the dice. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott has the latest.
Dan Cook watched the confusion from his perch as an analyst at IG Markets in Chicago. First, the UAE's central bank said it would stand behind banks burned by Dubai World. But then a Dubai finance official said the government would not back the company's debt and that creditors had to take responsibility for their own lending. Cook says currency investors were not reassured.
The yen, first of all, really took off as the number one safe haven currency, and the dollar also followed with strength. Because people were more risk-averse after the conflicting statements.
Investors are worried Dubai's state-run companies could default on their debt and the damage could spread around the world. But Hani Sabra with the Eurasia Group isn't all that concerned. He says it's just a matter of time before Dubai's oil-rich neighbor, Abu Dhabi, realizes it has to step in. Its stock market fell 8% today.
They know that already the UAE brand has taken a hit in the last 4 or 5 days. And I think they want to limit that damage, so they will get involved in a big way.
Abu Dhabi has bailed out its once high-flying neighbor before with a $10 billion loan. If the more conservative emirate rides to the rescue again, Sabra says Dubai will pay a price.
Abu Dhabi will be the dominant city-state, and Dubai won't be able to make the kind of decisions that it's made over the last 7 years without getting approval from Abu Dhabi.
Even if the damage is contained, analysts say the situation in the UAE shows just how fragile the global recovery still is. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Debt seems to be a theme on the broadcast today. You know, in the olden days, debtors were put in stocks in the public square, shamed until they were able to pay up. These days, it's increasingly lenders in the hot seat. In its latest try at rescuing the housing market, next month the Obama administration is going to start publishing the names of mortgage lenders who are taking their time lowering the interest rates for struggling homeowners. From Washington, John Dimsdale reports.
The government says 375,000 homeowners have cut cheaper, temporary deals with their mortgage companies. Borrowers are saving an average $576 a month. But Assistant Treasury Secretary Michael Barr says lenders are taking too long to make those new terms permanent.
The number that have been converted to permanent modifications thus far is low, and servicers need to do better.
Banks get about $3,000 from the government for each permanent modification. Now the government will start calling each company twice a day for progress updates. And next week it will publish a list of each lender's record of permanent modifications. The administration wants all the temporary deals to be finalized by the end of the year. But economist Richard Moody says that's not enough to get most banks to give up the income from existing loans, as long as those loans don't fall into foreclosure.
They're trying to do, I think, as little as they can to keep these loans current. After all, they are looking at the totality of their portfolio and all the fees that they can collect, be it delinquent fees and other processing fees.
As for publicizing scoff laws, Moody says better to appeal to the bank's bottom line than to their sense of shame, and that might be in the offing. Administrators of the $75 billion modification program are talking about unspecified penalties and sanctions for lenders who refuse to make permanent mortgage changes. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Depending on which article you read today, Black Friday sales at major retailers were either just fine, thanks, or completely disappointing. Today, though, is Cyber Monday, the day we all shop online on company time. Black Friday, just easier. No parking hassles, no lines at the register. Sally Herships has more on the birth of a shopping pseudo-event.
It's 2005. George W. Bush is president. The New England Patriots win the Super Bowl. YouTube is born. And the National Retail Federation invents Cyber Monday. It's supposed to do for online retailers what Black Friday does for brick-and-mortar ones, create a bargain-hunting frenzy. John Lawton is president of Home Depot Online.
Cyber Monday will be one of our top two or three sales days of the year.
Last year, consumers spent $846 million on the big day. This year, deep discounts on things like flat-screen TVs and clothing are expected to push sales to $900 million. Still, not everyone likes the shopping holiday. Pete Fader is a marketing professor at Wharton.
Most mom-and-pop retailers are still afraid of the internet and don't like the idea that someone might avoid coming to the store or buy less in the store because instead on Cyber Monday they're going to go to websites.
Fader says focusing so much attention on one day, whether it's Black Friday or Cyber Monday, can be risky.
It's a terrible thing. It screws up manufacturing cycles. It's tough for the retailers. It's hard from a staffing standpoint.
Try telling that to Stephanie Nelson. She's what you might call an Uber consumer. She founded the website couponmom.com.
What matters most to the shopper is saving money. So if we can save more money, I don't care what they call the holiday. Cyber Monday is my favorite holiday.
Even if retailers made it up. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You want some cyber shopping? I've got some for you. Shares of Amazon.com hit a split-adjusted all-time high today. Elsewhere on Wall Street, traders didn't really seem too worried about that whole mess over in Dubai. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Construction pretty much everywhere has slowed to a crawl since the recession started. That is true in housing, and it is true in commercial real estate as well. Back in 2007, developers in Chicago broke ground on a soaring, twisting skyscraper designed by the renowned architect Santiago Calatrava. That project never really got off the ground, though, so now organized labor is looking to use the tower as its own kind of stimulus project. From Chicago Public Radio, Adrian Hill reports.
The design plans for the Chicago Spire are stunning. At 2,000 feet, it would be one of the largest buildings in the world. But the actual work site is less impressive. It's little more than a hole in the ground. There's been no work on the site for over a year, since the developer ran into money trouble. Now, the AFL-CIO is looking to step in.
We're trying to get monies invested to get the project going, to get the Spire project going.
That's Thomas Villanova. He heads the local Building and Construction Trades Council. He says under the proposed deal, union members would do all the work on the spire. He estimates 7.5 million work hours, which makes it well worth the possible downsides.
We have up to 30% unemployment in some of our locals. We have people losing their benefits, their homes, their families, because they haven't worked in such a long period of time.
Villanova wouldn't get into specific dollar amounts, but the investment being discussed at a meeting today is reportedly around $170 million.
That's a hell of a lot of money.
Robert Bruno is a labor expert at the University of Illinois Chicago. He says the AFL-CIO has used funds in the past to create economic opportunities for its members, but the size of this project makes it striking.
It is a terrific stimulus to job creation and to wealth creation.
That is, Bruno says, if the deal works out and the building is actually completed. In Chicago, I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
I know it feels like the healthcare discussion has been going on for months, and Sure, it has. But today the Senate really got down to it. As debate on the Senate's final bill got started this morning, Majority Leader Harry Reid said he and his colleagues would be working weekends to wrap things up as quickly as possible. So far, a lot of the attention has been on health insurance, how health care is paid for. Far less work is being done on containing those costs, costs that continue to rise in part because newer treatments and medicines tend to be pricier than existing ones are. And yet, they don't always produce better results. Today, as part of The Cure, our ongoing coverage of the healthcare overhaul, one of the thorniest questions in the whole debate, how to balance innovation and cost control. Joel Rose went to the University of Pennsylvania to check out a cutting-edge cancer therapy.
In the basement of Penn's new proton therapy center, facility manager Eric Backus shows me a big round metal object that looks like a small submarine. He nearly has to shout to be heard over the fans keeping it cool.
It's basically a 220-ton magnet. The cyclotron spins the protons around and shoots them out through the beam line.
The cyclotron creates a beam that's more precise than other forms of radiation, so doctors can direct it exactly where it's needed.
If you're able to give a higher dose of treatment and have less side effects, that's a great win-win situation.
Stephen Hahn is chair of radiation oncology at the University of Pennsylvania. He says conventional radiation can badly damage the healthy tissue around tumors. Hahn hopes proton therapy will help treat cancers where tumors are close to vital organs.
The physics of protons are undeniable. If protons were the same price for treating a patient as regular radiation, we would not be having this discussion.
But the price is not the same. Proton therapy centers are expensive. This one cost $140 million, and the treatment typically costs 50% more than conventional radiation. That contributes to higher medical bills and, indirectly, to higher insurance premiums for the rest of us.
I got mine. I received my treatment, and I'm proof positive that it works, that you don't have to give up your sexual function or your urinary function.
This is Bob Marchini, a.k.a. Proton Bob. He was treated for prostate cancer 9 years ago without any of the nasty side effects that can accompany surgery or radiation. Since then, he's become somewhat of an evangelist for proton therapy. He started a volunteer organization of men who've had the treatment for prostate cancer. It has more than 4,000 members.
At any one given day, one of our members, or two or three or four, are standing up in front of a group someplace giving a presentation on treatment options and, in particular, proton therapy. That is causing an increase in demand, and that delights me.
That demand hasn't gone unnoticed by hospitals. There will soon be 6 proton therapy centers in the U.S., with at least 4 more in the pipeline. Hospitals see proton therapy as a way to distinguish themselves regionally and nationally by treating cancers other hospitals can't. But these facilities take an enormous investment, and that means pressure to generate income. Anthony Zeitman is an oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital.
The best way to do that is to treat as many patients as you possibly can. So from a business perspective, it makes great sense to treat prostate cancer patients.
Even if those patients don't need it. Zeitman says many prostate cancers are slow growing and don't require treatment at all. For those that do, Zeitman says there's still no clinical evidence that protons are a big improvement over cheaper alternatives.
That's the reason why University of Pennsylvania and Mass General are trying to do a randomized trial comparing one treatment with another. Then at least we'll be able to quantify if proton beam is superior in prostate cancer by how much.
The University of Pennsylvania's Stephen Hahn is convinced that proton therapy will prove indispensable for treating certain childhood cancers and head, neck, and lung cancers.
If we can define the patients where proton therapy really does benefit them, then I would say as a society we have to come up with the money to do this because it's the best thing for cancer patients.
Just maybe not all cancer patients, but once you've spent more than $100 million on a proton therapy center, it can be awfully hard to say no. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, theft, lies, and the rule of law in Russia.
A man is dead, and it's impossible not to try and find out exactly who killed that man and why.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added a third of 1% today, 34 points, closed at 10,344. The NASDAQ put on 0.2%, 6 points, finished at 2,144. The S&P 500 picked up a third of 1%, that is 4 points, closed at 1,095. The Dow's gain of 6.5% for November marks its fifth straight winning month. The NASDAQ added 4.9%. The S&P 500 advanced 5.7% during the month that ends today. Not enough Black Friday shopping sent retail stocks dropping. Macy's reversed close to 4%. Target missed the mark by 2.3%. JCPenney unpacked more than 2.75% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.19%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. By Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities, and is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs, such as Marketplace Money, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratch Pad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for October. In Detroit, automakers release sales figures for the month of November. And events around the globe mark World AIDS Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The idea behind social entrepreneurship is to do good through capitalism, create a business to accomplish some worthwhile goal, feed the hungry maybe, or sanitize a slum. The Acumen Fund out of New York City calls itself a nonprofit venture fund, directing financing to those worthwhile goals. Acumen runs a fellowship program, too, teaching young capitalists how to create and sell goods or services in developing countries, meeting the needs of the needy, if you will. A new documentary called The New Recruits follows three of those fellows during their years abroad. Seth Kramer helped produce and direct. Heidi Crowell is one of those new recruits. She went to New Delhi to sell solar-powered lanterns. It's good to have you both here.
Yeah, great to be on with you.
Great to be here.
Heidi, when you discovered, or you were told, I suppose, that you were going to New Delhi, you went back and you told your parents, listen, I just got out of this great business school and I'm moving to India. What'd they say?
You know, my dad was a Vietnam War vet, and he had been in the Army Reserves for 30 years. And he took, you know, foreign service really seriously. And he just wanted me to be aware of the risks, the challenges, and to take that awareness and sensitivity with me when I went to a place like India, which does have, you know, challenging areas. It has big cities, but it also has tribal belts and deep rural areas where the rule of law doesn't always apply.
Seth, what was it about the stories that you followed in the movie that made them so attractive?
We wanted to see if we could represent this program well and really get sort of the diversity of the participants. So we ended up choosing three of the fellows. There's a guy named Siraj who's from India, and he finds himself in the middle of Kenya working for a company that's trying to build pay-per-use toilets in the slums where you have 1.5 million people that are living without sanitation systems. Then you have a guy named Joel. He is a bona fide member of the religious right from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who finds himself in, of all places, Pakistan, trying to help this company that's selling drip irrigation systems to poor farmers who have no idea about this new technology. And then there's Heidi. She's a Stanford Business School graduate, a tall, blonde Californian who finds herself in a string of remote Indian villages trying to sell solar-powered lights to people who don't have electricity.
There's a moment when you're in that village, or maybe it's actually when you're in the offices a bit earlier talking about this trip, but you, in a voiceover, you say, I spend an amazing amount of my time here not being understood. Explain that.
Just from a pure language perspective, that connection wasn't always there. I didn't speak Hindi and I don't speak Marathi. So just communicating was challenging. And also the perspective I had, the ways that I had been trained and had experience in building businesses and establishing partnerships, the same rules didn't always apply. And so I think trying to find ways to understand intentions, form connections, and form partnerships proved pretty challenging.
Was there a moment where you discovered how to make the rules apply, or did you sort of figure out a way to make the rules work for you?
I think it's pretty much impossible to bend India to your way. So figuring out how you can be creative to mold yourself to fit in is usually a better tactic.
Seth, when you first came up with this project, where did you think it was going to lead?
When we first started developing the project, the idea of charging poor people for essential goods and services seemed like it just would absolutely not work. I wanted to know who thought this was a good idea. And if it does work, I really want to see it. And I didn't think that it could work because I really didn't understand what it means to be poor. I'm not going to speak for the 4 billion people on the planet that live on less than $4 a day, but the people that we encountered wanted to have the same choices that consumers have in the Western world.
And you, Heidi, what did you learn?
The message of how important it is to listen to the voice of customers is in solving the issues of the poor. The poor want to have the tools and opportunities to solve problems for themselves. Traditional aid treats the poor as passive recipients. Using markets, using entrepreneurship and business gives the poor a voice into the products they have available to them. And that's a voice I don't think business really can afford to ignore any longer.
On the topic of what you guys did during the film, isn't there a limit to this? Doesn't there come a point where you've done all you can do?
There's so much to be done. You know, there are 500 million people in India that don't have access to power. D-Light design will impact, you know, 10 million lives in 2010, but one solution is not going to be enough.
The film is called The New Recruits. Seth Kramer is the director. Heidi Crowell is, I guess you might say, one of the featured players. Thanks, you guys.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
The New Recruits is expected to air on PBS sometime next year. In the meanwhile, there is a link to find out more about that film on our website. It's marketplace.org. The story you're about to hear sounds a little bit like something out of one of those Cold War spy thrillers, complete with evil Russians and guys who somehow wind up mysteriously dead. Police in Moscow were looking into how a lawyer in their custody did, in fact, die. Sergei Magnitsky was awaiting trial on what his supporters say were trumped-up charges. His death has caused an outcry in Russia and also in the UK. Magnitsky was working on behalf of a British investment firm. And before he was arrested, he said he had evidence that Russian officials had perpetrated a massive tax fraud. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
37-year-old Sergei Magnitsky died in a Moscow jail 2 weeks ago. Russian authorities said it was natural causes. But his colleagues claimed that he died under very suspicious circumstances. Jameson Firestone runs the London law firm that employed Magnitsky.
People saw him. He was at a court hearing on Thursday. He's dead on Monday, and he's got bad bruising on his hands as though he's been in a fight or a scuffle or something.
Unusual for a lawyer, Firestone does not choose his words carefully.
A man is dead, and it's impossible not to try and find out exactly who killed that man and why.
Sell $50 or a dollar
by $60.
Some of the answers may be found here in this London-based investment firm, Hermitage Capital. Magnitsky represented the firm in Moscow. Until 4 years ago, it was the largest foreign investment fund in Russian securities. The fund manager, Bill Browder, had pursued what for a while was a highly successful strategy.
To invest in large Russian companies, and then in order to get those companies to improve, we would go in, analyze how the management of those companies were stealing money, and then publicize it to get them to stop.
He admits that investment strategy doesn't look too clever now. He made powerful enemies. In 2005, he was booted out of Russia. He managed to get all of his funds' money out, but he claims his Moscow companies were then hijacked by corrupt officials. His lawyer, Magnitsky, had been looking into whether those officials had used Browder's companies to improperly apply for a massive tax refund.
My offices were then raided. The police then stole our companies. The companies were then used for a fraudulent $230 million tax refund. My lawyer, who was helping us uncover this, was then arrested, and he died in prison.
Magnitsky had been in custody for about a year. After 11 and a half months without charge, he was himself accused of tax fraud. The lawyer's untimely death could represent the most serious indictment of modern Russia's legal system. Rupert de Cruz speaks for the British lawyers' organisation, the Bar Council.
The death of a lawyer is a matter of particular concern if that death is unlawful and is connected with the professional activities of the lawyer, because that amounts to a direct attack on the rule of law itself.
Russia is hardly known for upholding the rule of law. Troublesome lawyers and journalists have died suddenly and violently before. But the case of Sergei Magnitsky could just be a turning point, say his supporters. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has ordered a full inquiry. Jameson Firestone believes it will be thorough because, he says, the case concerns the theft of Russian taxpayer money.
Somebody ripped the Russian people off, and if they do investigate it, a lot of corrupt people are going to come down, and it's going to really improve people's belief in President Medvedev's pledge to fight corruption.
But Firestone concedes that everything depends on how far up the food chain the alleged corruption goes. He notes this: tax refund claims in Russia typically take months to process and usually fail. The allegedly fraudulent claim that Magnitsky was investigating was paid out in 3 days flat. It seems someone in a very high place could be involved. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. By Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation about Dubai World not paying its bills. A year and a half ago, back in March of 2008, we took Marketplace to the Middle East, including a week in Dubai. We did a lot of reporting about the region as a whole, of course, but I also had a chance to really look around in Dubai itself. And here's the thing that stuck with me. Everybody knew what was happening there was crazy, but nobody seemed to care. And on that depressing note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 34 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ added 6 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 put on 4 points. That's 0.3%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this broadcast, how to get by when the giving slows.
I really look at what we do as a business, and that you have to look at it as a business. I mean, we're in the business of caring.
We start our annual series on philanthropy. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.